This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris, and I hope you'll join me for Counterpoint coming up next. And just a reminder, the preceding program, This Way Out, is heard every Monday evening between 7:30 and 8 p.m. So stay tuned for Counterpoint, and as always, we bring you the White Rose Calendar right now.
In 1942, the White Rose was a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the horrifying agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers a weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggles of marginalized peoples. Here are the current listings. The May Day Celebration Committee invites individuals and organizations to help plan and participate in the 21st Annual May Day Celebration and International Workers' Day Celebration taking place on the New Haven Green on Tuesday, May 1st from noon until 7 p.m. For more information, call 203-776-2170 or send an email to maydaynewhaven@yahoo.com. The Cinema Arts Center of Huntington, New York will be showing two noteworthy films this week. On Tuesday, March 27th, join Peabody and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Nolan Walker for a question-and-answer session and reception following the screening of Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple, a stunning portrait of the rise and fall of Jim Jones' infamous cult. The 12 Disciples of Nelson Mandela, a son's tribute to unsung heroes, is a look at the group of South African men who spread the word about South African equality and played a significant role in that country's struggle for independence and equality. This film will be shown on Thursday, March 29th. All film screenings begin at 7:30 p.m. and are held at the Cinema Arts Center at 423 Park Avenue in Huntington, New York. Tickets are $9 for members and $12 for the public. Reservations are recommended by calling 631-423-7611 or by going to the box office. For more information, please visit www.cinemaartcenter.org. A Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Nonviolence Study Group will be taking place at Wisdom House at 229 East Litchfield Road in Litchfield, Connecticut from 7 until 8:30 p.m. starting on Tuesday, March 27th and running through the month of April. The group will read and discuss the book, The Autobiography of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., along with Kingian Nonviolence Conflict Reconciliation. Participants are required to bring a copy of the book to each session. Peace educator and certified Kingian nonviolence trainer Victoria Criscow will lead the sessions. For more information and to register, call Victoria at 860-567-3441 or send an email to soundbody@mac.com. The Urban League of Southern Connecticut will lead the call to assess the achievement gap with their first education summit on Thursday, March 29th at the Sheraton Hotel in Stamford. This year's theme will be At Risk in America, African American Male Achievement. Panel discussions will include several of the brightest minds in education today from across our state and our nation, including George Coleman, Interim Commissioner on Education for the State of Connecticut, and Eric Cooper, President of the National Alliance for Effective Education. Registration is now open and available at www.ulswc.org or by calling 203-327-5810. On Saturday, March 31st, join other concerned citizens in a protest to end torture and close Guantanamo Prison, taking place from 12:30 till 1:30 p.m. in front of Ferguson Library at Bedford and Broad Streets in Stamford, Connecticut. For more information, contact Richard Duffy at richard@richardduffy.com. That's richard@richardduffe.com. East End Women in Black began its vigil at the wharf in Sag Harbor in August 2002 to stand against violence in the Middle East and against the occupation of Palestine and the invasion of Iraq. Join East End Women in Black on the first Sunday of each month at the Monument at Ocean Road and Route 27 and on the third Sunday of each month at the Sag Harbor Wharf. All vigils are from 3 until 4 p.m. For more information, including a vigil schedule, visit www.eewib.blogspot.com. To include your group's upcoming demonstrations, meetings, lectures, films, and boycotts in the listings of the White Rose Political Calendar, send information about national, regional, statewide, and local events at least 2 weeks in advance when possible to the White Rose Political Calendar, WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. The White Rose can be found on the internet at wpkn.org/White Rose. Today's calendar was produced by Suzanne Vick.
You can hear the White Rose calendar every Monday evening at 8 o'clock and at different times during the broadcast week here on WPKN in Bridgeport. Stay tuned next for Counterpoint. Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here every Monday evening between 8 and 10 p.m. I'm glad you could join us this evening. We have a packed show. We have David Swanson, who will be on in just a moment with us. He's the co-founder of the group After Downing Street. We'll be talking about the legislation passed this past Friday in the House of Representatives and the internal debate that's now going on within the progressive anti-war community about the pros and cons of that legislation. A little later tonight, Mark Green will be joining us. He is New York City's first public advocate and now president of Air America Radio. He's also head of a new group called the New Democracy Project, and they're advocating a whole platform of changes in terms of secrecy in government, transparency, and the like. We'll be talking about both those topics. Harvey Wasserman will also be joining us. He's an author and journalist. We'll be talking about the unfolding Ohio election fraud scandal, as well as similar scandals ongoing in Florida. He's also an authority on alternative energy and solar power, and we're going to be talking about his book, Solartopia, sort of in the context of Al Gore's recent appearance on Capitol Hill and the kind of lack of any in-depth discussion on global warming and climate change. And lastly, we'll be talking about universal health care with Juan Figueroa, president of the Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, talking about some efforts being made here in our home state in terms of getting some kind of legislation passed that would provide health care to all citizens here. And, of course, that's a larger fight on the national scale, but that's coming up later tonight. But right now I wanted to welcome David Swanson to the program. David, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thanks for having me.
David Swanson, as I said a moment ago, is co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.com. He's the Washington director of Democrats.com and board member of Progressive Democrats of America. He was a former press secretary for Dennis Kucinich's 2004 presidential campaign as well. David, I just wanted to describe briefly for the listeners who may not be aware of the legislation passed in the House on Friday. By a 218-212 vote, the Democratic leadership under House Speaker Nancy Pelosi won a vote on her bill, H.R. 1591, which authorizes $103 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, with an additional $7.4 billion for training equipment and taking care of wounded soldiers once they get back home. The bill totaled $124 billion with the inclusion of more money for what some are calling pork barrel projects for domestic programs designed to attract votes. 14 Democrats at the end of this voted against the measure, and only two Republicans voted for the bill, which calls, I guess the essence here is, which calls for most American troops to be withdrawn from Iraq by September 1st, 2008. President Bush has promised to veto the legislation if it makes its way past the Senate, which it may not. But, Dave, what's your overall view of what happened here in the House?
Well, if people watched their televisions a little bit on this, they got the story that the Democrats passed this quasi-treasonous bill that instructs the president to end a war that he's involved in fighting, and then it was a big win for the wacky liberal Democrats. If you were involved in any way in the peace movement, you were actually lobbying against this bill because you didn't see it as ending the war, and I don't see it as ending the war. In fact, this bill does not use the power of the purse, which is the power Congress has to say beyond this date or after this withdrawal or after these conditions, no more money for the war. It very explicitly avoids doing that, so that when we get to a couple of months before the next election, Bush will refuse to end the war, and the Democrats will be able to pretend they wanted him to end the war, but they won't have used any teeth in the bill to make him do it. And the date at which that happens is dependent on what claims Bush makes about how things are going in Iraq, which is absurd to begin with. But one of the things he has to make sure happens is that an oil law is put in place that effectively steals massive oil profits from the people of Iraq and gives them to foreign corporations, which is a large part, arguably, of what he wanted out of this war in the first place. There was a measure in this bill to require the president come to Congress before attacking Iran. They took that out. They took out anything about not building permanent bases in Iraq. And they put in so many loopholes. Soldiers can stay in Iraq to guard other soldiers, to guard bases, to guard embassies, to train Iraqis, that you're not going to have to bring very many troops out of Iraq, and there's nothing that says a single one of them has to come home. In fact, the Democratic leadership is talking about moving them and the war to Afghanistan. So this was a very different bill from a bill that would use the power of the purse to fund a withdrawal and bring our troops home. This was not the bill we elected the Democrats to pass.
Well, David Swanson, there's a lot to talk about in terms of the internal debate among the anti-war movement in this country. I know Representative Barbara Lee of California sponsored a bill that was not allowed to be voted on the floor of the House that angered people in the Progressive Caucus, the Anti-War Caucus, who wanted to have a fair hearing for Barbara Lee's bill. That didn't come about, and in the end, the Anti-War Caucus released their members to vote with Pelosi and for this bill. They say it was for pragmatism because they didn't have the votes to pass the Lee bill, the Barbara Lee bill. What do you say to the idea of pragmatism versus idealism, and there had to be a start here somewhere?
Well, both pragmatism and idealism are good things. I would argue that considering both, voting for this bill or encouraging anyone else to vote for this bill was the wrong decision. It may have been the right decision for Democratic politics, for beating the Republicans in 08, though I think probably not. Probably the American public is going to see the Democrats as cowards who have not taken any real action. But it was the wrong decision if you care about continuing to kill hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. as the majority of Americans actually do want to end this war. I mean, this is majority opinion, wanting to end this war in the coming months. Barbara Lee and Lynn Woolsey and Maxine Waters and many others have sponsored a bill to fund a withdrawal. So has Dennis Kucinich. So has Gerald Nadler. There are a number of these bills. Barbara Lee had an amendment written up to amend this supplemental spending bill to direct all of the money into a withdrawal and into training Iraqis and to have the withdrawal complete by the end of this year, 2007. And that means bring out all the troops and bring out all the mercenaries. And Barbara Lee did not propose that in the Appropriations Committee because she didn't have the votes there. She wanted to propose it on the floor of the full House, and she moved in the Rules Committee to do that and was blocked. And the argument's been put forth by the Democratic leadership that they needed to block her amendment or they would have had to allow Republican amendments and all sorts of other amendments. Not true. The Republicans never allowed Democratic amendments, and they always allowed the Republican ones. And the Democrats could have allowed Barbara Lee's amendment, and we could have gotten a real count of how many members stand for ending the war. Better than that, the leadership could have pushed a bill that was Barbara Lee's amendment in the first place, and with enough pressure and bribery and threats of the sort they applied to the progressive Democrats, applied to the conservative Democrats, they might have passed a strong bill.
David Swanson, what at the end of the day do you think would have happened if the Pelosi bill had failed? Would it not have been perceived as a victory for President Bush that the Democrats couldn't muster even a weak need opposition to the war resolution in the House of Representatives? Wouldn't that have been a far worse result? I mean, that's a lot of the commentary you hear from people who take a view of this thing as being more pragmatic or not making the perfect the enemy of the good.
Well, Nancy Pelosi herself and her colleagues were spreading that message beforehand. If this fails, this will be the message. They didn't need to be doing that. In fact, if this had failed, and largely due to Republican votes, all but two Republicans in the House voted against the thing, Nancy Pelosi should have announced that she just pulled a rabbit out of a hat and ended the war, and the Republicans ended it. And, you know, needless to say, although it apparently needs to be said over and over again, the Pentagon has far more than enough money to withdraw our troops in a safe and orderly manner now without Congress passing any legislation. And if this legislation failed, Congress has not lacking in any of its responsibilities. It has no responsibility to continue to fund an illegal occupation of a foreign country. We may be at that point very soon if Bush follows through on his promise to veto the bill. We will be back to the drawing board, and the Democrats can do nothing, or they can do a Republican bill. Here's your money, no strings attached, not even these pretend little waivable limitations attached. Or they could do a serious Democratic bill to fund a withdrawal and end the war.
Well, what's the scenario you have? What's the preferred scenario if President Bush, as expected, vetoes this bill? What would you like to see the House Democrats do? And the Senate as well, although the margin in the Senate is far closer and they don't have a lot of room to pass much there.
Well, depending what comes out of the Senate and the conference committee and lands on the president's desk, if it resembles the Pelosi bill, my money is on him signing statementing it. That is, he will sign it into law and then in a completely unprecedented, unconstitutional, illegal manner will write a statement the next day indicating which portions of the bill he will ignore. And Nancy Pelosi won't make a peep. And the onus will then be on the American public to raise holy hell about a president illegally unwriting a law as he signs it into law. But if he does veto it, then we're back where we were a month ago, and we need to pressure the Democrats in the House to take the right approach this time, to start from the left rather than the right, to start with the third of the Democratic caucus that openly stands for ending this war quickly with the power of the purse, get the leadership behind that. That gives you two-thirds of the caucus. and then start pressuring the Blue Dog Democrats to get on board. Then it's clear where everyone stands. It's the Democrats as a real opposition party versus the Republicans, and we have an effort to end the war. And if it fails, we tried, and we still managed to end the war.
We're speaking with David Swanton, co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.com, and we're talking about the House vote this past Friday on a resolution that gives President Bush the money he wants to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan with a really a not very strong plank within the bill that said that the U.S. troops should be mostly back home by September 2008. David, tell us a little bit about what was going on at the grassroots internet-based organization MoveOn.org and the poll that was conducted of the membership that many people felt was dishonest and rigged.
Well, all of the peace organizations were standing very clearly and adamantly and doing everything they could in terms of pressure and lobbying and sit-ins and demonstrations for Lee's amendment and for a no vote on Pelosi's bill unless Lee's amendment passed. There are various activist groups that sometimes are with the grassroots and sometimes are following wherever the Democratic leadership tells them to go. And in this case, True Majority went out and did a poll of its members. And so, of course, its members backed the Lee Amendment, and so True Majority backed the Lee Amendment. Move On was then under considerable pressure to at least look as if it was listening to its members. So it sent out a poll to its members that didn't give them the choice of the Lee Amendment. It gave them the choice of the Pelosi Amendment, described in glowing terms, or nothing. And so you had, do you want to back the Pelosi Amendment, or do you want to do nothing and get something worse, some Republican right-wing pro-war agenda? And so, of course, the small number of their members who responded voted for the Pelosi bill. And Move On went out and announced, our members are for the Pelosi bill, which everyone understood to be as opposed to the Lee Amendment. And in fact, Move On's directors, you know, talked about it in these terms and understood that that was the debate. Is it for Lee or for Pelosi? And yet they had specifically not polled their members on the Lee Amendment. They left that choice out. And it, amazingly to me, Eli Pariser from Move On has said, told reporters that the reason they didn't poll was that they knew their members supported the Lee Amendment. So it's really a travesty. I mean, it's if you're going to pretend to be a grassroots, member-driven organization, you can't conduct yourselves that way. And I don't wish ill to Move On. I wish they would listen to their members and do better next time.
Well, I hope what comes out of that is a grassroots, I guess, a sock on the chin of the leadership of Move On to respect their members' opinions on these important issues a little more and trust, as you said, their membership's intelligence to understand the issues thoroughly. I think, as you said, and others like John Stauber have written about this situation with Move On, it appeared that in their offices, the Move On leadership basically said this is the way to go, and they shaped a poll to get the desired results, of which only, 116,000 out of 3.2 million of the members responded with a vote. So it's quite clear there should be a shakeup at MoveOn.org to usher in some real democracy there.
There should. I mean, I can see why not too many people responded. It looked, as Stauber has called it, like a Soviet poll. Do you want to vote for our guy or not? You know, it wasn't much of a choice. There wasn't a conflict in there. And so a lot of people didn't respond at all. But, you know, if Move On wanted to make the case to its members, look, here's the Lee Amendment. We love it, but it doesn't have a chance. It won't pass. It'll get a low vote, and that'll just make the peace movement look bad. Or whatever they wanted to make as their arguments, make them, and then let the members choose. And if their members don't buy their arguments and their members want to back the Lee Amendment, then listen to your members.
David Swanson, we don't really as yet know how this will all turn out with a presidential veto or new legislation, stronger or weaker. It's hard to tell at this point. But with the Democratic majority in the House voting for this authorization to spend money on the war in Iraq, do they now own that war? That many of the Democrats have certainly, at least in their own minds, really don't want to own, because they would much rather have the Republicans and President Bush bear the full brunt of the blame for the war in Iraq and not be seen as complicit in it. And of course, that has a lot to do with their electoral strategy in the 2008 presidential and congressional elections, where they hope to capitalize on the failures of Iraq and Bush and the Republicans.
Well, you know, a lot of the Democrats who voted yes did so because of petty little bribes and threats and pork projects thrown in and good things tossed in and threats of loss of committee chairmanships, of loss of electoral support next time, and so on. But the Democratic leadership really pushed this thing, and Congressman Rahm Emanuel has indicated to the Washington Post that he would just as soon have the war be going in 2008, but have it be the Republicans' war still, and have the Democrats look like they're opposing it. And that really seems to be the strategy they're taking when they pass a bill requiring an end to the war, but not using any teeth to enforce it, and timing it to just before the next election. And not only is that a disgusting approach when you're talking about literally throwing away the lives of hundreds of thousands of people at the rate that Iraqis are dying in this war and occupation, not to mention 1,000 more Americans or so, but it's electorally stupid. It's not how you win elections. This muddled middle-of-the-road-ism, inaction and cowardice is not proven to win any elections, and already the public is turning against the Democrats.
There is some sense that after this vote, where members of the Progressive Out of Iraq Caucus, their votes were critical in passage of the Pelosi bill. Now, it seems that they have a lot of leverage, do they not? I mean, if some of these progressive members had not voted for Pelosi, it wouldn't have passed, and the Democratic leadership knows that full well. So don't the progressives, don't the Out of Iraq Caucus members come out stronger here?
I don't know. I mean, there's, by some accounts, they've gotten a commitment from Pelosi to do a standalone bill on requiring the president to come to Congress before attacking Iran, which, needless to say, the Constitution already requires. But, you know, to the extent that they got anything out of the process, as far as I know, that's it. And I hope that that comes through. I think the Progressive Caucus would be in a stronger position to influence draft number two, should there be one, if they had killed draft number one rather than helping it pass and waiting for it to be vetoed. And they didn't do that. They buckled. And, you know, there were eight Democrats who voted no and one who voted present for the right reasons. There were six Democrats who voted no because they wanted an even worse bill. But as you say, the leadership of the Progressive Caucus and of the Out of Iraq Caucus, while voting no, told their members to feel free to vote yes, and that put the bill over the top. And I fail to see how that strengthens the Progressive Caucus.
Well, it could be. You know, who knows how these things really work? But you know, they could withhold votes next time. You know, I guess they proved they could put it over the top. They could also kill it. But there's all sorts of labyrinth of deals and handshakes that we'll probably never know about.
Indeed.
But last question for you, David, and that has to do with the ongoing grassroots movement for impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. And we should include a few more administration officials on that list now, like Alberto Gonzalez and many others. But I hear that there's an interesting series of events that will take place across the country on April 28th. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Indeed, a huge coalition of organizations, legal groups and scholars and activist groups and peace groups has put together a plan. You can go to A, as in April, 28.org, or you can go to the big coalition site, which is impeach07.org. And this is a day of impeachment events in cities and towns and villages across the country. And a lot of it is going to be some creative actions where we're saying to Congress, what do we have to do? Spell it out for you, and people will be spelling out the word impeachment in giant form on the beach or on in a field or on the street with their bodies on the ground. People will be making giant signs and posters and balloons and all sorts of other forms of spelling out the word impeach. And we think that this grassroots pressure is badly needed. The other thing that's helping us get there is the endless scandal upon scandal and the investigations finally moving forward and the subpoenas being resisted by the White House. We have the White House refusing to allow its officials to go and testify under oath in public to the Congress. And at this point, especially with a Supreme Court that considers itself employed by the president, there's no choice left to Congress but impeachment. And you have Republican senators like Hagel saying so. And you have one brave Democratic congressman, Dennis Kucinich, talking as though he may introduce articles any minute. But the rest of the Democratic caucus is silent for the same reason it went along with funding the war. Pelosi has ordered it so, and we're going to have to work to change that.
Well, David, I want to talk more about impeachment with you in the future, and I'll have you back on the program soon to talk about that. But lastly, leave our listeners with your website at After Downing Street. I know you also have commentaries on your own website as well, and any other information you want to throw our way.
Well, there are lots and lots of them, and afterdowningstreet.org is one of the most comprehensive with lots of resources and evidence and background info if you want to get into the issue of impeachment. And there's also a section you can get to by going to don'tattackiran.org, and that's the big issue in what we've been talking about. And when the president gets his hand on this money, an attack on Iran is very, very likely. So I would encourage people to get focused on that issue as well.
All right, David, thanks for making time for us, and we'll call upon you again soon talking about impeachment and some of the other important issues that we didn't have time to get into tonight in such depth. Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. David Swanson, co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org, and we'll have him back soon to talk about impeachment, as I said. But right now we're going to take a quick musical break here on Counterpoint, WPKM in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk, and we'll be back with Mark Green, who's the new president of Air America Radio, and we'll be asking him a lot of interesting questions about where he wants to take the network. But we're first of all going to be talking about an initiative called the Democracy Protection Act, which he's proposing, and all about the erosion of our civil liberties and democratic norms in this country over the past 6 years. So stay tuned for that. It's coming up next.
Jim and John, I'm a cousin. Ain't nobody hiring here since all the jobs are down in Mexico. Reckon that learning civil trade made me see the world. Moved to the city someday, married a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag and wondering how he got this far. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Blue moon landing in Kandahar.
Music from Steve Earle here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. Right now, I'd like to welcome to the program Mark Green, longtime public interest attorney, New York City's first public advocate and president of the New Democracy Project. More recently, Mark Green has been a candidate for mayor of New York City and New York State Attorney General. Mark Green is currently the new president of the Air America Radio Network and author of the book, Losing Our Democracy. Mark Green, thank you very much for making time.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you. Yeah.
Glad you could make it. Now, tell our listeners a bit, first of all, before we get into Air America and some of the other issues, you have a very urgent project right now I know you want to tell us about, the New Democracy Project. First of all, tell us about that organization that you work with.
It's Public Policy Institute. I started it in 1981 with the late Harry Chapin, the great folk singer. And the idea was if conservatives had these huge think tanks like American Enterprise Institute, Heritage Foundation, the progressive side should have some. And over the years, we've been publishing books and having colloquium. The most recent publication, which you kindly referred to, was last summer. I wrote Losing Our Democracy, about how Bush wants to export democracy while he sabotages it here at home. It's a blatant inconsistency. And then last week, four organizations, DEMOS, the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, Nation Magazine, and the New Democracy Project, didn't want to just curse the darkness. So we published the Democracy Protection Act, 40 ideas, ways that could help restore our democracy during this time of stress.
You want to summarize that 40 plank document that you guys came up with?
Sure. Well, first of all, any listener should know that if you went to newdemocracyproject.org, it's online there, so you can download it, both the summary and the whole thing. There are several areas: voting rights, rule of law, democratizing Congress, secrecy. All of them are indispensable to a functioning democracy. You have to encourage the franchise. You have to inform people. You have to follow the rule of equal justice under law. This administration has been so lawless, so hostile to expanding the franchise, so really authoritarian when it came to treating Congress when they controlled the White House and the House and Senate, which they no longer do. So you want voting by mail over 3 weeks before Election Day so you don't reduce turnout if there's a rainy Tuesday. You want to make sure that you have electronic voting machines that are secure and with a paper trail. You want campaign finance reform, which we have in New York City and Maine and Arizona have, where you have a floor under candidates who are competitive. So money alone doesn't buy races and merit counts for more. Free TV for bona fide candidates. I've been a candidate. I've lost. I've won. It's just not helpful to spend 60% of your time calling potential donors rather than dealing only with voters. Second, you have to open up Congress so you have more committee hearings. In the last 6 years, my goodness, the House and Senate were like West Wings of the White House. And all the things we're finding out now about Iraq, about Halliburton, about Gonzales, about contracting and Katrina were swept under the rug. Finally, there's an area called economics of democracy. You know, we're a private economy, and if you're smarter or more skilled, you'll make more money. That's fine. But when 90% of the wealth is owned by the top 5% of Americans, when 90% of the productivity gains goes to the top 1% of Americans, when the average CEO earns 500 times more than the average line worker, then the entire middle class and those who aspire to it are getting left behind. So if you add up all these positive solutions, we think we can save our democracy. And I think and hope a lot of the 08 election will turn on that.
Mark Green, you talk about the threat of the new authoritarians in power over these last 6 years, certainly talking about the Bush administration, the wiretapping, the torture, spying on Americans generally. You know, we're hearing about new abuses every day, including as the front page of the New York Times displayed recently. There was this very large surveillance project underway by the New York City Police, possibly in league with the FBI, about those who were coming to New York City to protest the Republican convention in the summer of 2004. This thing goes way out, and I'm wondering, what do you think the public perception is of the erosion of our civil liberties in the Bill of Rights? Because it seems to me that the response has been tepid at best.
You know, when bodies come back to Dover, Delaware, when you see scenes of carnage on television, when your income doesn't keep up with inflation, when your family has a working parent but not in health insurance, you can see the problem, and it affects and afflicts people directly. It's visible and direct. The problem with losing our democracy is, it's the old parable, excuse me, of a frog in boiling water. It doesn't know, as the water goes up to 70, 80, 90, 100, 110 degrees, that it's being boiled to death because it's so incremental. The problem with losing our democracy is that most people don't see it until they see warrantless wiretapping, until they see that demonstrators were arrested and incarcerated. Not because they've done anything wrong, but because Mayor Bloomberg, and I think is the biggest failing of his administration, preemptorily arrested people because he didn't want the Republican convention upset.
And kept them off the street for several days till they could no longer protest, right?
And, you know, if possibly bad people are tortured away from the cameras, well, that theoretically doesn't affect us directly. But the reason that America's prestige and support around the world is plummeting in polls is that we previously standed for the rule of law, and now, of all things, our country is torturing people. Not all of them are guilty. And even if they were guilty, we don't torture people in our prisons, and they're full of murderers and rapists, do we?
Well, we're not supposed to anyway.
Well, the cost is, in a current or future conflict, do unto others as they would do unto you. If an American is captured and tortured, what moral right does our country have to complain about that when we've done it? The reason you don't torture is to protect your own soldiers in the future. And that's why, I mean, senators like Chuck Hagel and John McCain, Republicans both, and John Warner, and of course senators in Connecticut and New York all, you know, are violently against, that's probably the wrong verb, ardently against torture. This administration, I've joked that when Bush took his oath of office to faithfully execute the laws, he took it literally. And he's ended laws that help consumers, help shareholders, stop torture, follow the laws when you invade people's privacy. And only now are we finding out more about it, because Congress is Democratic and finally scrutinizing them.
Our guest is Mark Green. He is the president of Air America Radio and also heads up the New Democracy Project. We're discussing his organization's Democracy Protection Act that is being put forward by a coalition of groups, including Demos, the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, and The Nation magazine. And Mark, you have any hope? This is quite an exhaustive list of issues and legislative measures that many people I know listening to this program would like to see voted into law. But what are the chances that the Democratic-controlled House and the narrowly Democratic-controlled Senate is going to pass this legislation or any of it advocated by your coalition?
Well, first, let me remind people that one of the authors of the Democracy Protection Act, actually most of the voting rights provisions, is Miles Rappaport. I hope your listeners remember some decade ago, he was the Secretary of State of Connecticut.
Yeah, and I used to work with him, actually, at the Connecticut Citizen Action Group. Yeah.
And then when he left public office, he didn't just go and make money, nothing wrong with that. He tried to make policy and founded and now runs Demos. You ask about the viability of it. I quote a Republican from Michigan in Losing Our Democracy, my book, saying if we don't suppress the vote in Detroit, we're in trouble. We know what that means. The more African Americans vote, they tend to vote Democratic, the more the Republicans will be in trouble in Michigan. Well, he let the cat out of the bag in a sense. And Republicans have had no substantial record in expanding the franchise and making sure electronic voting machines are secure, in pushing for authentic campaign finance reform. And so that the House and Senate are Democratic means that these ideas will all get an airing. For example, Senator Durbin of Illinois last week proposed a sweeping public finance bill. Senator Hillary Clinton, of course, of New York, has proposed a Count Every Vote Act. So it doesn't help if people vote and then votes aren't counted, which is what's happened, of course, in Florida in 2000 and elsewhere. These ideas will all have hearings and maybe even votes. They're not going to be enacted so long as there's a Republican president who doesn't believe in it and can veto it, and you need two-thirds to override him. It all comes down to 08. And if, after 08, there's a more progressive a president, and both chambers, my guess, politically, is that both House and Senate will be more Democratic, because the unmitigated disaster called Iraq will absolutely have many Republicans losing in 08. Then these ideas in the Democracy Protection Act won't just be pie in the sky. I think they'll be enacted. We had a near realigning election in 2006. You know, not one federal incumbent Democrat lost. Not one. Senator House. And, of course, the House gained 30 seats and the Senate 6 seats. If we have anything comparable to that in 08, these ideas of Miles Rappaport and the Brennan Center and the New Democracy Project won't be proposals. They'll be called laws.
I think that these 40 planks contained within the Democracy Protection Act are something everybody should take a look at. So we'll repeat the web address at the end here, but people can jot this down quickly, newdemocracyproject.org, and check out the 40 planks, because we can't go through each one. But they all look like the platform of a progressive political party, which maybe you're hoping the Democrats will adopt.
It's so odd that, let's say, Reagan runs for president. His goal is to transfer wealth to the elite, and he does it through tax cuts. But he masks it, as Bush did, by saying he's for freedom. And this is a party of flags and faith, and it's a good brand, and they won in 1980 and, of course, in 2000 and 2004. The thesis of the Democracy Protection Act is that progressive patriots are people who believe in democracy. And if too few people vote, or only wealthy people can contribute and control elections, and if the Congress is a broken branch of government, notwithstanding what we learned in civics class, and if the Bush administration is so persistently secretive that it doesn't disclose who sat on Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force, for example, and if laws are violated so often to help one political philosophy, look what's happened with Attorney General Gonzalez and the firing of those 8 U.S. attorneys. If that happens, we don't have a functioning democracy. And the people who, what's really pro-American are the people not just who wave the flag, but live up to it. And the problem is not those couple of idiots a year who burn a flag, which is symbolic but painful, but the people who don't follow the content of 1789 and our Constitution. They're the ones who are the true un-Americans. And it's about time that the public heard that from people who are full-throated about it.
Our guest tonight here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk, is Mark Green. He is the president of the New Democracy Project and the new president of Air America Radio Network. Mark, I wanted to ask you about how you came to become America's only progressive commercial radio network's president. I know your brother Stephen and you have worked together to secure the network, but tell us a little bit about the story of how that came about.
3 years ago, Air America was founded because the right wing not dominated, nearly monopolized talk radio. Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly. And clearly the country was, you know, roughly split politically. So it started with Al Franken as the biggest name first host, and Randy Rhodes is a great radio talent. It was a big, great idea that had missteps, mismanagement, misspending, and it went into bankruptcy, Chapter 11, in October of 2006. Expenses were out of hand, for example, and it wasn't being run like a business, but it was being run like an ideology. My brother bought it out of bankruptcy. I'm now the president of Air America Radio, and the goal is to make it profitable and influential. Hell, it can't be influential if it's not profitable. So Air America 2.0 now has new owners, new capital, a new management combination. Existing radio people now are joining us. We'll have a new national advertising and affiliate firm. We'll have an even better lineup, which we'll be announcing over time. And if we can't make the progressive equivalent of Limbaugh and Hannity successful in the 07-08 swing to progressive patriotism, we never will. I'm very optimistic it will now work. We've cut expenses, our revenues are increasing, and there's now a sense of new momentum, frankly, based on all the people who want to be Air Americans.
Mark, as Air America got its start, a very rocky start, there are a lot of commentators that I know you heard who are saying, progressive or liberal talk radio can't be profitable because people want to hear black and white answers. They want to hear people demonized or praised. They don't want any kind of nuance. The listeners here, because this is radio, commercial talk radio, and they say this is entertainment more than real political speech. It's, you know, Rush Limbaugh is an entertainer, not really a political, operative. But, of course, he is a political operative. It's obvious that he is. He has many millions of listeners. And they follow quite closely the ditto heads what he tells them to do. So it's a very powerful medium, and it's not merely entertainment. At least I'd make that argument. But I would have to ask you this. There was a document that was released, an internal memo from ABC Radio Networks recently, which kind of gave us a glimpse inside the radio industry, where it looked like some 90 major corporations in the United States had blacklisted Air America, saying they would refuse to purchase advertising on Air America. So it looked like you have these right-wing commentators saying Air America can never work, but it looks like corporate America was actually had drawn up the blueprint to create that reality, to make sure it didn't work.
Well, first of all, when a lot of conservative talk, TV and radio started, they had problems. Fox News, if you want to call it news, was massively unprofitable in the beginning. New York Post today loses tens of millions a year. Both wouldn't exist without Rupert Murdoch's subsidies. Fine. Any startup, from a restaurant to a radio network, it's hard. Actually, there had not been a new radio network started in 30 years, so Air America was very ambitious. Second, it is true that we're not just reading a ticker tape or an AP Wire story. Opinion radio has to be informative, sharply opinionated, and entertaining. And we think we have all three now. At the same time, it's true that a lot of the people listen to Rush Limbaugh, forgive me, there's a level of ignorance that's breathtaking and saddening. I mean, that a majority of Fox viewers still believe Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11 is a reflection on their bad reporting and the low education base of their listeners. We don't have ditto heads like that. It is true, and I'm happy, that a lot of our listeners are more discerning, want to hear both sides, but being opinionated is fine. If the New York Times and CBS Network News want to be more straight, that's their job. We are opinion radio. And if you want to hear a conservative point of view, go to Fox. If you want to hear informed, opinionated, and entertaining news and views, well, that's what Air America is.
Now, what about this memo, though? It seemed to really...
I'm sorry. I forgot about that.
But the memo seems to be an important issue because it really speaks to the viability of a progressive radio network where corporations are deciding ahead of time they won't touch it. They won't advertise on it, thereby strangulating it.
There are 20 million corporations in America, of course. They're not all huge. It is absolutely true that some large corporations don't want to touch controversial radio, right or left. And some of them don't believe in progressive values, so they don't want to advertise on Randy Rhodes or Rachel Maddow. Well, there are others who do. And we just got to make sure that we beat the bushes. I don't mean, no pun intended. So we're going to be even more aggressive in going into a city. And if some of the Republican businesses don't want to advertise in Air America, fine. They're allowed to withhold their funds. We'll go to businesses run by Democrats and say, advertise with us. You'll make sales and help strengthen a radio platform that advances your values. So it helps your bottom line and your spirit. And at the moment, our revenues are going up. One more thing. Given all these new platforms, we now are not just a radio, but a multimedia company. And so while we're spending funds to have people on radio like you are now, like I am now speaking, obviously people my kids' age, they're 22 and 28, can podcast it, can listen on, stream it. Soon we'll be videocasting our radio shows on cable, on the Internet. There are so many new ways to hear radio that when I say we have to think outside the box, I mean literally the radio box. And so I think it can be more profitable in the future, left or right radio.
Well, Mark, I just have to tell you a quick story about a local Air America affiliate here in Hamden, Connecticut, WAVZ. They actually axed the Air America programming recently, and there was a groundswell of some listeners with petitions and some protests. They didn't quite change the attitude of management at this radio station, WAVZ. But, you know, it demonstrated the depth to which people really need to hear more than just one side of the story, which all too often is what they get on talk radio. So it's to Air America's credit, you know, that they really fostered that kind of loyalty. But it's sad that, you know, it's a medium that is certainly can be here today and gone tomorrow, given the commercial bottom line of all these radio stations.
We want to reflect our listeners. We don't want to have a lecture. We want to have a conversation, in a sense. And when Madison, Wisconsin had an Air America affiliate and said they were dropping it, there was a huge backlash. The result, it stayed on because the owners saw, not that they're political, but they're commercial. They saw there was an audience that could be, as they say, monetized. Stayed on, and it's very profitable. Air America is hugely profitable in places like Portland, Oregon, for example. If it can work there, because they're good business people with great talent, it can work anywhere. And I think it will work anywhere. And now we've shaken off bankruptcy with this new ownership and a new vision for Air America 2.0. I think we're on the rebound. And the goal is we have 2.5 million people who are, in effect, Air Americans. And we want many more people to say, I'm an Air American, and to add to to add to our growing numbers.
Well, we're a non-commercial station, but I think we'll allow this commercial to stand. Mark Green, before you go, just one quick other thing, if I could. And that is challenge you recently put out to the New York Post and the Republican Party. I thought that was quite interesting, where you basically asked the New York Post to exchange commentators in the pages of the New York Post, one of the most right-wing newspapers around, right, as well as asking the Republican Party to have Air America Radio co-host the first GOP presidential candidate primary debates in New Hampshire, because, of course, there was a controversy recently where Fox News was asked to bow out of a Democratic primary debate in Nevada. That actually maybe isn't quite in sync with what you had in mind, but tell us what your thoughts were on this.
Well, the New York Post has editorialized and mocked liberals and Democrats for years. And I saw that they're good at monologues, but I didn't think they had the courage to engage in a dialogue. So I decided to test it. And I emailed to Bob McManus, the editorial page editor of the New York Post, and said, "Hey, Bob, let's not exchange insults. Let's exchange ideas. So you come on my radio network, and 2.5 million people can listen to you as we talk. And we'll have a good exchange. And then we once a month have an op-ed in the New York Post." He rejected it, just as I expected. All they want to do is have a conversation to similarly minded people. They can't win a debate about the war or Katrina or Walter Reed, and they don't want to start one. Second, when Nevada Democrats asked and then dropped Fox, because Fox was so right-wing, Fox bellyached, "Oh, this is anti-speech and Stalinist." So I wrote 4 Republican chairs in Nevada, and New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Iowa, the first primary caucus states, and said, "You know, Fox is complaining. Well, why don't you strike a blow pro-speech and anti-Stalinist and have Air America, a progressive talk network, host the Republican debate, just like Fox wanted to host the Democrat debate?" I did it deadpan, but admittedly slightly tongue-in-cheek, and they haven't responded. So Fox has nothing to complain about. But we're like Fox, only in that we're fair but unbalanced. They should admit what they are. And they're trying to pretend that they're a straight network, but they're not. They're a right-wing network which misleads people based on the values of their owners. And they're pretending to be a straight news channel. And they're not. And I thought we exposed that.
Well, Mark,
Robert Greenwald in his brilliant documentary called Outfoxed, if any of you want to download it on your TVs or go to your local store, you can do it.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 and 89.5 FM. It's 2 minutes after 9 o'clock, and we're just winding up our conversation with Mark Green. And, Mark, it's so important that we do have at least an equal time on broadcast media in this country. It's so skewed to the right, and I think what you're doing at Air America to revive that network with so much potential is great. And I'll just ask you this quick question here to, sure, to wrap things up, and that is, I'm happy to hear on Air America a lot of criticism of the Democrats, and that's something you don't hear very often on Republican talk radios. In fact, they're all reading from the same talking points very often,
right,
day to day. It's amazing. The same words come out of the same mouths day after day. How closely do you want to have America identified with the Democratic Party? What are the dangers in that? Because I know you're a lifelong Democrat. I'm sure many listeners to the network are Democrats themselves. But is there something, some distance you want to keep between the network and the party?
Well, there is a distance. We are not an arm of the DNC. I don't get their talking points. They can't call me and tell me what to air. Then we're not an authentic medium. We have to be a business. And that means being blunt about Republicans and Democrats alike. There's no party line. I don't tell the talent on air what to think. Some of them condemn different Democrats on different days. That's quite different than Fox, actually. We have to maintain our journalistic integrity while we have a point of view. I will say that Air America is run by me, and I'm a proud Democrat, and a COO who's been a Republican his whole life, because he's an honorable, effective person. That's what you want running a business.
All right. Well, thanks for being here tonight. Really appreciate you spending time with us.
I really appreciate speaking to your great audience. And thank you for your interest.
Yeah. And leave our listeners with both the web address for the New Democracy Project and Air America, if you would.
Well, Air America is just airamerica.com. And visit us. You can stream live and see what we're up to. And if you're interested in losing our democracy, it's in bookstores, but in saving it, that's the Democracy Protection Act. That's what I'm going to be personally working on over the next couple of years with candidates and officials and the public alike. And for that, you can get it by going to newdemocracyproject.org.
Great. Mark, thanks for all your excellent work over the years, and we hope we'll have you back soon to talk about the new chapter in America, Air America's life.
Look forward to it. Thank you so
much. Take care. Bye-bye. Mark Green, a longtime public interest attorney, New York City's first public advocate and president of the New Democracy Project and new president of Air America Radio Network. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with our next guest, Harvey Wasserman. Stay with us. Music of the Mammals, something called Do Not Go Quietly Unto Your Grave. It's 10 minutes past 9 o'clock here on WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Still coming up tonight, we have Juan Figueroa, president of the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut. We're going to be taking a look at some efforts being made to pass legislation that would bring universal healthcare to the citizens of the state of Connecticut. And the bigger picture here in the entire country, where 43 million people in the United States do not have any health insurance at all. A huge issue that's going to get bigger as we get closer to the 2008 presidential election, no doubt. At least that's my hope. Right now, though, I'd like to introduce a really good friend of this program, Harvey Wasserman, author and journalist, who has investigated voter fraud for the freepress.org, an online news organization. He's a longtime activist and authority on electricity deregulation, alternative energy, and nuclear power. And he's the author of the book Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. Harvey, thanks a lot for making time for us.
Well, it's great to be with you again. Really, you do a great show, and it's really an honor.
Oh, thanks. We just had Mark Green here talking about Air America Radio. He's the new president of Air America Radio, which is kind of interesting. And the state of media is so pitiful. I'm glad they injected a little money into that project. We'll see what happens. But anyway, I wanted to talk to you, first of all, about new developments in the investigations into voter fraud, both in Ohio and Florida, that you've written about on at thefreepress.org. But also, as we conclude, I want to make sure that we talk about some of the topics that you deal with in your book, Solartopia, Global Warming, and we can sort of bounce off Al Gore's recent testimony on Capitol Hill. But
I think it's so great that with Al Gore we have the confluence of both the election protection issue and the environmental issue.
Exactly. You know, you're right.
Quite ironic, you know.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. I hadn't even thought of it. But, yeah, they said the last time Al Gore was in Washington before this recent appearance was he had to gavel the official seal of approval on the 2000 election, which he won the popular vote and, you know, by all accounts was cheated out of the presidency by the Supreme Court. But anyway.
Yes, and he would not allow, as you recall, he would not allow a challenge from the Florida delegation, or rather from the Black Caucus, to the theft of the election. It's one of the low points in all of world history, American history anyway. And, you know, and one thing he's going to, if he does run for president, one thing he's going to have to face up to is that moment in 2001 in January when the Black Caucus was trying to challenge the seating of the Florida delegation, and Gore wouldn't allow them.
Well, was it that he wouldn't allow them, or was it that one of the House members needed a senator to sign on with him, and no senators would sign on? That's
remember. You raise a very good point, and I have always wondered about that. Paul Wellstone was a friend of mine, the senator from Minnesota, and I always wondered, who died under very suspicious circumstances in a plane crash in 2002. And I always wondered about that moment. Why didn't Paul Wellstone stand up with the Black Caucus to challenge the results in Florida? And I was told after Paul died by his staff that Al Gore told the senators that he would not recognize them if they stood to join with the Black Caucus and to challenge the seating of the Florida delegation. It's an astonishing moment in history. And, I give Al Gore a lot of credit for coming back and for raising the global warming issue. I have a lot of issues with what he's asking be done. I think it's great that he's established the reality of the of global warming in the public mind, but I take issue with his solutions, which I think are very wimpy. But, he was presiding over the U.S. Senate, and a joint session of the House and Senate, actually, and he had the power to recognize Paul Wellstone and refused to do it.
Well, that's interesting twist on it. I hadn't heard that before.
Oh, no. Well, I hadn't heard it either until last year. When I was in Washington and met some of his staff. But the law, which was passed in 1887, states, as you said, that a senator and a congressman can jointly challenge the seating of a delegation from an electoral college delegation from a state and require a two-hour session, each house separately, and then they get together. And the Black Caucus in 2001 wanted to challenge. And from my understanding, Paul Wellstone had agreed, and Gore said he wouldn't recognize him.
Well,
so one of the great ironies of our modern history is that in 2000, with Al Gore presiding over the Congress, we could not get a constitutional challenge to a stolen election. But in 2004, with Dick Cheney presiding over the Congress, we did.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Was it Barbara Boxer?
Yes, Barbara Boxer of California and Stephanie Tubbs Jones of Cleveland. Joined in the challenge. And it's the first challenge ever in U.S. history of the seating of a state delegation to the Electoral College.
Mm. Well, that brings us to Ohio and Florida and some recent developments that you've been writing about. Tell us, first of all, what's happened in Ohio in terms of Cuyahoga County and the newly elected Democratic Ohio Secretary of State, who's taken some actions against board members who have clung on despite some fraud and revelations of misdeeds there.
Well, it's an amazing situation, and I was born in Boston, but I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and I saw in 2004 in my backyard the theft of an election, and you have to have been there. In the precinct I grew up in, which is now predominantly black, it took 5 hours to vote, and in the precinct I live in now, which is all white, it took 5 minutes to vote. And this went on all over the state, and we documented, Bob Fitrakis, my co-author and I, documented over 100 different ways that the 2004 election was stolen. And just for the record, for your listeners, I will tell you without any hesitation whatsoever that John Kerry was the legitimate victor in the 2004 election, certainly in Ohio.
What was the margin statewide, 118,000 or something?
Yes, a little over, it fluctuates, but it's a little over 118,000. And originally it was 136 or so, and they trimmed out 18,000 votes. But we know that many, many thousands more were stolen, and many, many thousands more than that, people who wanted to vote were prevented from voting. So you had what a fellow named Steve Rosenfeld calls a combination of Jim Crow and Boss Tweed, which is a great phrase. You know, Jim Crow intimidating voters and preventing them from voting, and Boss Tweed stuffing the ballot box, and that's what happened in Ohio. I would venture to say, with a if a fair election had been held in Ohio, if all who wanted to vote had been allowed to vote, and if the votes in turn had been fairly counted, I think John Kerry would have won Ohio by about 250 or 300,000 votes. And you know, I've been following Ohio politics for more than 40 years, and you know, we knew at 9, 10 o'clock at night that Kerry had won. And then all of a sudden he had lost, you know. But Fetrakis and I predicted it, actually. Didn't take any great rocket scientists, although I'll comment on it in a minute. But we wrote a piece a week before the election of 2004 for the freepress.org website, which continues to run our stuff, listing 12 different ways that the election had already been rigged. And this was a week before the election, and everything that we said came true, and then about 93 other things. And I will say that George Bush and Karl Rove met in Columbus on Election Day with J. Kenneth Blackwell, the Republican Secretary of State of Ohio, and Matt Damschroeder, the Republican Executive Director of the Franklin County Board of Elections. And, you know, I am the plaintiff in the lawsuit that has won the federal preservation of the ballots from the 2004 election. And we part of our strategy has been to subpoena Rove's laptop, which we can't get. But we believe that we have reason to believe, I mean, more than just a conspiracy thought, there is substantial evidence that Rove's laptop may well have been connected into the central tabulators for the state during the 2004 vote count.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, I know Bobby Kennedy Jr. Wrote a piece in Rolling Stone using a lot of the research that you and Bob Fetrakis had dug up on investigating the fraud and the various techniques that were used to keep people from voting in Ohio.
Right.
But tell us a bit about this Cuyahoga board and things that have happened, you know, in the last week or so.
Well, it's a spectacular set of developments. I mean, I feel like I'm about a third of the way into Watergate here. You know, we know that the law was broken many different times in Ohio, and that what was done during the 2004 election, and again in 2005, by the way, and then again in 2006, was illegal. And in Cleveland, which is the largest county in the state and a very heavy Democratic stronghold, you know, that's where the black population is concentrated in northern Ohio, and those wards were going 85-90% for Kerry. And the Board of Elections of Cleveland, the setup in Ohio is that every county, there are 88 counties, they all have a Board of Elections which has two Democrats and two Republicans. That's how it's structured. But so you might have a few tie votes. Who breaks the tie votes? The Secretary of State. And then when Blackwell was in there, that meant Blackwell controlled the whole election apparatus. And then, thank goodness, in 2006, we had a huge Democratic sweep. And we have a Democratic Secretary of State and a Democratic Attorney General. The Secretary of State now runs the show, and she, her name is Jennifer Bruner, looked into what was going on in Cleveland. And the first thing that happened was, and this was not her doing, there was indictments and then convictions, two felony convictions of poll workers within the Board of Elections for rigging the recount in 2004. And what happened in the recount was that the Green Party and the Libertarian Party raised more than $100,000 to force a recount of the presidential ballots. And under the law in Ohio, to do a recount in a county, you have to just pick at random 3% of the vote as embodied in a certain number of precincts, but it has to be done at random. And then you do a recount, and you compare that to the official vote tally. And if they match, then you don't have to recount the whole county. But if they don't match, then you have to hand count the entire county. So what they did in Cuyahoga County, which is huge, is they rigged the recount by picking specific precincts to hand count, knowing that there would be no problem and that they would, you know, come out in agreement with the official tally. And this is illegal. And the county prosecutor called them, he prosecuted, and he got two felony convictions against two poll workers there with 18-month prison sentences. And, you know, I feel sorry for these women. I mean, you know, they're just basically way down the totem pole, and they were forced to do what they were by the Republican chair of the Board of Elections. His name is Bob Bennett, and he's also the chair of the Ohio Republican Party. And so Jennifer Bruner, after these convictions came in, and there were a whole lot of other things that went on, including there was a documentary shown on HBO that focused, it was a national showing, focused on the decision in Cuyahoga County to buy $20 million worth of Diebold voting machines for the 2006 election. And the citizen election protection community vehemently objected, but Bob Bennett, you know, basically shouted them down and spent $20 million taxpayer dollars on riggable Diebold machines. And, of course, they went into the primary in 2006, and the whole thing blew up. And they wound up spending another $11 million, and the vote tallies came in many days late and are dubious and really unreliable. And so Jennifer Bruner did her duty and fired the Board of Elections, which is in her power to do, and which Blackwell did, actually, when he demanded their resignations. So she actually didn't technically fire them. She demanded their resignations. And the two Democrats on the Cuyahoga board have resigned. In the last couple of days, they both resigned. But Bob Bennett and the other Republican are refusing to resign. And so here you have a situation of this Democratic Secretary of State who has asked for the resignations of the Republican members of the Board of Election of the biggest county in the state, and they're refusing to resign. And what she did 2 days ago, which we wrote up in a major piece which carried on commondreams.org, is she now has issued it's in a new piece, which is freepress.org. That one has not been picked up by Common Dreams, a new piece. It's there now on freepress.org, and it lists the five major pieces of her complaint against these two Republicans. And I don't know how anybody in their right mind would want to stand in a public hearing and face these charges. I mean, you know, she basically has laid out a pattern of malfeasance and dereliction of duty and misspending of public money that would make your hair stand on end. And, you know, if this procedure goes ahead, I mean, she accuses them, which is very clear, in 2006 of alone of wasting $12,900,000 because they mishandled the primary and general election. They didn't secure ballots. The keys to the ballot rooms, which are supposed to be locked at all times, were floating around. There was illegal access to the central tabulators, which we think is what could have swung the 2004 election statewide. There was a purge. We reported this first, and now she's picked it up. There was an inexplicable purge of 10,000 voters off the rolls in Cuyahoga County because of a new registration system. Now, we know that in Cuyahoga County, leading up to the 2004 election, there was a purge of 170,000 voters just in Cleveland, which is the Democratic city. As we said, Bush won by less than 119,000. Here you had 170,000 purged in precincts which are going 80-85% Democratic. I mean, do the math. That alone could have put George Bush back in the White House. So, you know, what we're looking at now here in Ohio, and it's like, you know, it's every bit as good as the Final Four, is a public hearing where the Democratic Secretary of State, she's a youngish woman, I guess she's in her 50s, going against old Bob Bennett, who's in his 70s, and just kind of this paunchy backroom Republican wheeler-dealer. And I cannot imagine that Bennett is going to be stupid enough to go through with this hearing. But if he does, I hope he does, frankly. Mm-hmm. It'll be spectacular. And if you want to read about it, it's at freepress.org. We also had another thing simultaneously break. We came across a memo from Hocking County, a small county, a rural county. And in that memo, the Republican chair, again, the chair of the Board of Elections there in Hocking County, a woman named Lisa Schwartzy, circulated a memo where she specifically directs the board to handpick a precinct for the recount. Now, that's completely illegal. In other words, as I mentioned, you're supposed to recount by at random. She picks a precinct because it has just the right number of people in it, and she's put it in writing.
And, you know, we just saw two women in Cleveland sentenced to 18 months in prison for doing precisely that, and here we have a written memo. So we'll see if the Attorney General gets involved in that level.
Hmm.
And that's the kind of thing. But, you know, these things are happening now every other day in Ohio. And what you've had is that, you know, in the wake of a stolen election 2.5 years ago, stuff is really now hitting the fan, and it is amazing to watch, I tell you.
Well, it's really
the unraveling of the election.
I want to thank you personally, and I know a lot of listeners have followed your work on this, you know, for quite some time, and you guys are to be commended for all the investigative work you've poured into this, which has really led, I'm sure, to some of these new revelations, at least new for people of Ohio and the rest of the country. Harvey, we're running out of time, and I want to make sure you say a couple of words about the Florida 13th District. Tell us about some late-breaking developments in Florida's disputed congressional election in the 13th Congressional District there in Sarasota.
Well, as you know, there was a bizarre disappearance of a mere 18,000 votes, which decided the election for, of course, a Republican over a Democrat going to Congress. And we have seen the surfacing of a memo from ESNS, the major voting machine company there, saying that if you hit the thing to cast a vote, it may not turn up because the software is insufficient. And so what you have to do is post the election workers there, the poll workers, to post a sign telling voters to push the machine really hard, because otherwise it's not going to register.
Now, this memo talks about the problems with the machinery before the election took place, right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It was in a primary. And these are the very machines on which 18,000 votes miraculously did not turn up for the Democrat. People who voted Democratic primarily, but somehow failed to vote for the congressional race. In other words, these are ballots or electronic ballots that came through from people at the polls who voted in a hotly contested election, but somehow decided not to vote for this particular congressional candidate. You know, this happened especially in New Mexico, a tremendous undervote, especially on Indian reservations, by the way. A very, very substantial percentage of people who voted on certain Indian reservations in New Mexico went in and voted in the hottest contested presidential election in recent memory, and filled out the entire ballot but did not vote for president. You know, and these are in precincts that happen to go 80-90% Democratic. And so the same thing happened in this congressional race in Florida. They basically stole the election from the Democratic candidate, a woman who, to her credit, challenged it, but was snuffed out. I mean, we've had too many situations where Democrats, again, have won and been defrauded of their victory, but have not stood up. And this woman did stand up, and this new memo now indicates very clearly what probably happened, which is that the voting machines were set up to not accept a vote for a certain race in these heavily Democratic precincts.
The Democrat in the Florida 13th District, Christine Jennings, who was defeated by Vern Buchanan, you know, with all these missing votes, has she exhausted her challenge? Has she appealed this decision, or she's gone as far as she can?
I'm not sure about that. But I know that the Congress has certified the Republican to sit in the seat.
So it's probably
over. And that makes it, you know, very difficult. Mm. And they did that in the San Diego precinct, San Diego congressional race. But it was the Democrats' fault. I mean, she clearly won. Harriet Busby, I think is her name, and just didn't challenge. And all the evidence shows that the election was stolen. And they kind of whisked this guy off. This is when the Republicans still had control of Congress. They whisked this guy to Washington to swear him in before she could mount any kind of challenge. And they're doing this. We had it in Columbus, in Central Ohio. Central Ohio is now heavily Democratic, and we have not had a Democratic congressman since 1982, I believe, because it's so gerrymandered. But we did win a race here, and the woman lost, Mary Jo Kilroy, lost by 1,000 votes. We know she won. She did fight it for a while, but her people would not listen to our people. And you know, I want to say one thing, by the way, Scott. You commended us for doing this reporting, and I will tell you, I'm certainly happy for the praise, but to this day, in an election that was very clearly stolen, no major media has come in to follow up on any of our stuff. And we have been, you know, we have practically begged the Democratic Party and begged the major media to come in here and deal with this story. And we, Bob and I continue to be the only reporters in any media with any kind of reach that's doing the reporting. It's mind-boggling.
Well, that is just insane, and it leads me to my final question here because we've run out of time. But and I'll have you back to talk about some global warming issues in your book. Solartopia is the book that you've got out, and we'll give the web address before we say goodbye. But just on this question of investigating the evidence of fraud, the machinery of the elections, now that the Democrats are in control of the House and narrowly in control of the Senate, do you have any hope that the Democrats will repair the machinery of the elections so we don't have these kinds of stolen elections and missing ballots and electronic voting which doesn't record a voter's preference? Do you have any hope that they'll make progress on that before the 08 presidential election?
Well, we want to get rid of all the electronic voting machines. There is the Holt bill, which is very controversial now, by Rush Holt from New Jersey, which makes some ameliorations, some improvements to the electronic voting situation. But we think there's no hope for electronic voting. The closest we want to get to electronic voting is with Scantron ballots. If you want to, you know, pencil in a Scantron and let them tabulate it, as long as there's a paper trail, that's reasonably acceptable, although we prefer a hand count of paper balloting. But electronic voting machines, which are allowed under the Holt Act, we do not support. And, you know, some people say the Holt bill is better, half a loaf than none, but we want to get rid of electronic voting machines altogether. They are machines that are perfectly designed to steal elections. That's what electronic voting machines are for, is to steal elections. Just like television is designed to sell product, you know, electronic voting machines can never be secure. And we want paper ballots, and that's where it's at as far as we're concerned. Just like we want solar energy. I mean, you know, I'm watching Al Gore sell the case on global warming. He's done a good job, but we need to go way further than he's willing to advocate at this point to get solar energy, to get rid of nuclear power and shut down the fossil fuel industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rush Holt bill, you're saying, is flawed because it does allow these electronic voting machines to continue to be used. Is there any legislation that that counters that whole idea of maintaining electronic voting machines?
On the federal level, I do not know of a bill, and I may be misinformed or you know, less informed. I don't know of a bill right now that bans voting machines altogether, although I think Dennis Kucinich may have one up. Dennis Kucinich has been very good on this issue. You know, he's from Ohio. He saw it happen as well, and he's been aggressive, and I believe he may have a bill in that does ban voting machines, electronic voting machines. I'm not sure. But that's what we need to do. And, you know, the Holt bill seems like a good start, but we really cannot afford to risk. I mean, look, you know, we've had 8 years or 7.5 years or how many Bush has been in of utter catastrophe. And the one thing that we can say with pride about George W. Bush is that the American people never elected him president. You know, but look at the consequences of having him in there. We have had stolen presidencies before. In the 18th century, or 19th century rather, in 1876, in 1824, 1888, but 1896 most importantly, but never two terms in a row, and never with this catastrophic kind of consequence. George W. Bush is the essence of an unelected president, and we cannot let this happen again, or we're going to wind up with another guy like him.
We're going to lose our democracy real quick if we don't take corrective action on a whole bunch of fronts, and it's been good to talk to you tonight about these new developments. It's hopeful that some of this stuff is coming out in the wash finally, Harvey Wasserman. And leave our listeners with the address for both freepress.org as well as the other address for Solartopia.
My brand new website is solartopia.org. I've written a utopian novel about a world that's totally free of fossil and nuclear fuels, and it does work by the year 2030. It's all based on available renewable technology, and takes about an hour to read. It's called Solartopia, Our Green Powered Earth, AD 2030. I think people will like it. It has a theme song by Pete Seeger and an introduction by Bobby Kennedy Jr. So I've had a lot of fun with it. I think people will like it. And hopefully Scott will be able to talk about it next time.
Yeah, let's have you back soon. We'll do something on focus on that, as well as some more updates on the election stuff, because that's quite
important. Oh, it'll be hot and heavy. We'll be talking about the indictments next time.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Thanks, Harvey.
Thank you, Scott. Anytime.
Bye-bye. Harvey Wasserman, author and journalist, has investigated voter fraud for the freepress.org, And glad he could be with us for a little bit tonight. We're going to make way for our next guest after this bit of music. So stay tuned here on WPKM in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. The program is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and I should just mention this, that if you want to hear this program in its entirety each and every week, you can go to whiterosesociety.org. That website carries audio files of the full two-hour program. They're free, downloadable, I think even podcastable. I'm not quite sure. But it's free, whiterosesociety.org. And our friend Bob Fitrick is, I'm forgetting his name. Oh, Bob Birch out there has helped organize a website that archives many progressive radio talk shows from around the country, and we're happy to be there, too. And you'll find all sorts of interesting stuff there at whiterosesociety.org. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment.
All right. 1, 2, 3.
Those who start wars never fight them. And those who fight wars, they never like them. And those who write laws,
this is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint, and Art Hansen is next. He'll be here from 10 p.m. till midnight, so stay tuned right after this show. But I want to thank Juan Figueroa for joining us tonight. He is the president of the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, and they're working on some hopeful legislation in the Connecticut legislature. And Juan, thanks for being here tonight.
My pleasure.
Tell our listeners a bit about the interesting history of the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, particularly how you got your start with a lawsuit.
That's right, Scott. The Universal Healthcare Foundation is a public charity, and our focus really and our mission is to serve as a catalyst in engaging people and communities and ultimately getting a universal healthcare policy, bill, law enacted in the state of Connecticut so that every state resident would have access to a doctor or an insurance policy or health insurance policy. And that's our mission. But as you suggested, the foundation started about 4 or 5 years ago, And it was as a result of a lawsuit that was brought by community activists, organized labor, some church members, whom together with the Attorney General of the state and the Comptroller of the state of Connecticut joined hands and, in essence, suing Anthem Insurance when Anthem Insurance took over Blue Cross Blue Shield of Connecticut. And what's otherwise known as a conversion, they demutualized the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Connecticut. And typically, when that happens, the public policy has been to put up X percentage of what may be that business deal, what that business deal may generate, and start a foundation that would focus on the underinsured and the uninsured. And many times the way that it happens is through litigation because insurance companies or the company that's at play many times won't do it voluntarily. So we're fortunate that in Connecticut there were a number of activists who put this together, and then the foundation was created, and the settlement amount of originally $40 million, which today is worth $50 million, was put together as a result of that litigation. And and now we're glad to have this foundation out there working on universal health care.
I would think this is quite unique in the entire country, where you actually have an endowed foundation working for universal health care as a result of the litigation you just detailed for us, but it's very hopeful.
I must say that you should know, and your listeners should know, there are about 165 conversion foundations in the country. There are three in the state of Connecticut. There are a number of them, of course, in the New England region, and I do have to say that we're the only ones that that carry the name that we have, and we carry it very proudly, and mostly because I think the board of directors and certainly we as staff have embraced this notion that that this foundation is dedicated to systemic issues, meaning to dealing with the issue of health care in a systemic way, in a fundamental way. No more patching up of the system, and I think it's refreshing to have a public charity, a major foundation, invest its resources through grants, through research, through communication, and the like, in tackling an issue in this kind of manner. So we're happy. I'm happy to be there, as I know the board of directors is, with promoting this idea of fundamental, comprehensive universal health care for the state of Connecticut.
Just curious, and I want to get to the more substantive issues of universal health care in Connecticut and legislation and the like, but who selects the board of directors over there? How does that happen? Is the state involved, or is it a private affair, or how does it work?
Well, technically, it's a we're a nonprofit public charity, and we're incorporated as a nonprofit under the laws of the state of Connecticut, and we have what's called a self-perpetuating board. But you should know that when the settlement agreement took place and the foundation was created, there was a board of directors that was put together as part of the settlement agreement. And that was the original incorporating board of directors, which, as I mentioned before, that then has become a self-perpetuating board. And as a result, we have 15 members on the board. And you should also know that we have two corporations, and they're interlocking, I guess that would be the best way to describe it, because we have something called the Connecticut Health Advancement and Research Trust, which is the main corporation, and then we have the Universal Healthcare Foundation, which is a supporting corporation. And between the two, as I said, there are 15 members on the CHART board. There are 10 members on the Universal Healthcare board, and it's self-perpetuating under the laws of the state of Connecticut.
Well, Juan Figueroa, tell us a bit about what's happening in the state legislature that would give us some hope that universal health care legislation will move forward this year.
Well, listen, first of all, I think it's exciting in the sense of, you know, an issue gaining the momentum that universal health care is, both in the state as well as in the country. And there are many folks who have been battling this issue for many years, and as you know, this issue dates back to the days of Roosevelt. And ultimately, the issue is about the country, in essence, putting together a national health care program, ensuring that every resident in this country has access to a health insurance policy or to a doctor. And so in the state of Connecticut, I must say that over the course of the last 18 months in particular, the issue has really risen to the top of the political agenda. And certainly going into this legislative session, which started in January, where we had seen the governor make a proposal. She called it universal health care. I mean, I think there's some real issues as to how much reach it really does have, but she making a proposal, the president of the Senate, Don Williams, making a proposal and talking about a Medicare for all type of plan for the state of Connecticut. In the House, you have the Speaker of the House focusing in on kids, but more and more talking about adults, and certainly with a lot of his Democratic caucus members talking about universal health care as well. So if you gauge it by the political establishment and the plans that have been talked about, certainly there's a lot of action and a lot of momentum there. But let me say this, you know, one of the things that we pride ourselves as a foundation is really, and as I said, it's in our mission, engaging people and communities. And I say that because ultimately I think what is most important and what I think will carry the day is in our ability to engage lots of people and to really shift the power equation on this issue, meaning we as residents need to own this issue, and ultimately when the decisions are made in the Capitol, the powers that be will need to take into account the thousands of residents that are going to be involved in this issue, whether it's through organized labor or whether it's through community organizing or whether it's through chambers of commerce, which we fund. We as a state, as residents and as voters, need to own this issue, and hopefully the grants that we provide, which are approximately $2.5 million a year to a wide variety of groups, like I said before, from chambers of commerce to organized labor to advocates of healthcare reform, and beyond our grants, the ability to organize, and you should also know that we fund a number of organizing grants, and I mention that now because our next big organizing piece is a rally that we're having on May the 5th at Bushnell Park in Hartford, where we hope to bring thousands of people, again, in what we're calling sort of the ultimate public hearing on this issue. But it's really to stand up for health care, to be counted, because ultimately it really does matter, engaging and pushing for change. So that's May 5th at Bushnell Park at the Capitol, a big show of support and a demand for universal health care for the state of Connecticut.
Now, what kind of universal health care do you envision would be possible to pass legislation on here, given that many other states, most recently Massachusetts and California, are looking at maintaining the private insurance companies, maybe on the scale of one state, a single payer is not viable? But I want to ask you about that because I believe Canada began its universal health care journey with one province, Saskatchewan, putting into place, on just a provincial-wide level there, you know, similar to our states. So what is the possibility that we could get a single payer health care system versus some of the patchwork plans that we're seeing develop both in Massachusetts and California?
Well, Scott, you know, first of all, certainly if you were to ask me a year ago what was possible, it would have been, the answer would probably have been very different than what I would say today, which I think today, I think the opportunity for having something that is really a fundamental change in the healthcare system, I think we're a lot closer to that, and it's a lot. I think it's much more possible than certainly conversations we had about a year ago. But here's the thing: from the foundation perspective, everything ought to be on the table. And when I say that, let me first say that the foundation has subscribed to the definition of universal health care that has been put forth by the Institute of Medicine, which is part of the National Academy of Sciences, the bipartisan group in Congress that does research, in this case on health care. And they put out a report a couple of years ago on the uninsured, and in it they provided a definition for universal health care, which we subscribe to. And it's a matter of five principles that we think that no matter what plan gets adopted in Connecticut, it ought to meet these five principles, and they're as follows. They're very straightforward. Number one, we're talking about universality, meaning everybody covered, or everybody having access to a doctor. Not 98%, not 95%, but 100%. Number two, health insurance ought to be portable, meaning you should be able to take it from job to job, or you should be able to take it from job to unemployment status and vice versa. There's no reason why you need to lose insurance when you're in the midst of those changes. Number three, it needs to be affordable, particularly for low and moderate income families that are sort of in between qualifying for a governmental program, but many times work in these businesses that don't offer health insurance. And by the way, that includes a lot of small businesses. Number four, it needs to be sustainable for the state, meaning there is enough, as we all know, being spent on health care today. The estimates in the state of Connecticut is that we spend in the upwards of $22 billion on health care between public and private. And certainly estimates of being able to cover the uninsured are between 1% and 3% or less of that $22 billion in terms of its cost. We ought to be able to find a way of financing and dealing with affordability, with quality, and over the long term be able to sustain it in a much better way than we're doing now, which is we're spending a lot of money, putting it at the back end, spending money on people going to emergency rooms and the like, very inefficient and with worse health outcomes than we otherwise could have. And then number five, the fifth principle is there are elements of both health, wellness, and prevention that need to be a part of this discussion, that need to be part of any plan. And that's something that we subscribe to. That's part of the fifth element of the Institute of Medicine principles. So all of our plans, we measure up against those principles. We put forth in a document called Sounding the Alarm. That's a document that was done by some national researchers that we hired, three plans, two of which meet that definition, one of which doesn't. And the first model, Connecticut Saves, it's actually a single-payer type of model where the state would become the insurer. The state of Connecticut would be self-insured, as many other companies do. Actually, Pitney Bowes, for example, is a self-insured company, while the state of Connecticut becomes self-insured. That's model number one, Connecticut Saves. Then the second model that meets the IOM principles in that Sounding the Alarm report that we put out is Connecticut Select Care Choices, and that is, in essence, a purchasing pool that the state would develop so that everybody has access to this purchasing pool, and people would be offered a menu of private insurance as similar to what the marketplace offers right now. But the economies of scale and being able to deal with or work with a much bigger pool would allow for sort of the cost issue as well as some of the other issues that around quality and sustainability over the long term that we're looking forward in a fundamental change. So those are at play, and actually both of those models have now been turned into legislation at the Capitol.
Well, that's good news. It's some progress being made, and it's an urgent issue. I don't think there's any family, unless they're extremely wealthy, who this is not an issue for. And in terms of portability, it's a huge factor in what people decide to do or not to do in terms of jobs, you know, and keeping one job or taking a risk on another job. All this has a lot to do with your health insurance and being protected and knowing that you're vulnerable if you take a job that doesn't have health insurance. It creates a lot of anxiety, has bankrupted. I think it's the number one cause of bankruptcy in the country.
That's correct.
People who can't pay their medical bills. It's just a horrendous situation, and I'm beginning to have more hope that it will happen. Go ahead.
I think so. I think it's going to be a fundamental, one of the big issues of the 2008 presidential race. So at the national level, I think it's going to get attention it hasn't gotten before, certainly in the recent past. And I think that what you're seeing is, with the federal government being totally derelict about it, not addressing the issue, clearly the states are having to pick up and be creative about it, and that's what you're seeing in the state of Connecticut right now.
Now, in your dream of dreams, do you think that Connecticut could be one of the first states that would put in place a single health care program here? And I guess, are the politics aligned in such a way where you would have, the governor and the legislature lined up? And then, of course, we have to factor in the insurance companies, many of which are based here in Connecticut, ironically enough. And I know for a fact they certainly don't want to put themselves out of business or marginalize their profitability by, welcoming in a single single payer health care program, which, in large part cuts out all the private insurance companies.
Well, look, I mean, it's certainly a proposal where we have the state self-insured would be a on the political level, the anybody would say it was either the toughest one to achieve. That's certainly true of any state, but I think it's certainly it's accentuated here. It's a bigger issue here because the insurance companies do have such a big presence and historically and currently have such economic and political clout in particular. On the other hand, you know, one of the things, you know, it's one of the models that we put out there because we all have our eyes open to, okay, so where do we want to spend the money? Now, listen, the fact of the matter is that as both as a country and certainly as a state, we're spending upwards of 40% of our healthcare dollars is going to paper pushing, bureaucracy, and that's mostly the third-party payer system that we have, i.e. insurance companies. Now, look, we can have a reasoned debate and say, okay, is that how we want to spend our money? Well, maybe in Connecticut we come to the conclusion that those jobs are more important than some of the other aspects of reform. I don't know. But we ought to have our eyes open to it. I think it ought to be on the table. And look, I mean, they're not going to go out of business necessarily because what they would be losing is the Connecticut market. And I'm not ready to buy that they'd be losing the entire Connecticut market to begin with because under any of these plans, people could still buy private insurance. But it ought to be on the table. We ought to consider all the angles and ought to have our eyes open to how we're spending our healthcare dollars now because we're spending lots of money, lots of dollars on it, and we're just not getting the bang for it.
Well, Juan, I guess lastly, we're running out of time here, and I want to make sure we get the phone number and web address in, and maybe you can also leave us with some idea of what we can do as citizens here in Connecticut to be active on this issue. Now, you mentioned a rally May 5th at Bushnell Park, but I know there's probably other things people can do as well.
Absolutely. I mean, we're asking people, May 5th, that's an important rally, and you'll have more information about that, but certainly, we're asking people to contact their legislators, your local state rep and senators. This is being debated as we speak, and it's really important for people to hear from you. Send them an email at the state capitol, whomever your state rep or state senator is, and ask them to support universal health care from our standpoint as defined by the Institute of Medicine Principles. We have a website. We're part of the work of the foundation is overseeing this campaign called Healthcare for Everyone. And that is actually the website address, healthcare4every1.org. I'll repeat it. healthcare4every1.org. That's our campaign website that will give you up to the minute information about all the activities that we're funding and the different kind of forums that we're having around the state, particularly in that part of town, in that part of the state where your radio listeners are. We're having several forums. And I encourage people to go to the campaign website and know about when they're taking place.
All right. Well, Juan Figueroa, it's been great to have you here. I know there'll be a lot more to talk about in the future, so we'll invite you back. And it's very promising that this finally may be happening. Who knows?
We hope so. Thank you very much, Scott, for having me on. I'll be glad to come back as this sort of campaign evolves. And by the way, whether it takes the next 2 months or the next 2 years or whatever the case, the foundation is committed to keep working on this in the long term.
I'm very glad to find out that you guys exist and the work you're doing. Thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Juan Figueroa, president of the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut. And that does it for our program. Art Hansen is up next here on WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. I'm going to leave the number here so that if you want to contact myself or anyone here at the station, you can call with your feedback, suggestions for topics and guests and the like. That's area code 203-331-9756. 203-331-9756. Our mailing address is WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Our website address is WPKN.org. And many of the interviews are edited down and put into our syndicated program, Between the Lines Radio News Magazine. And you can go to our website and sign up for free weekly summary, program summaries, as well as interview transcripts and podcasting and downloads of audio, all at btlonline.org. BTL, standing for Between the Lines, btlonline.org. And this full two-hour program called Counterpoint that we do here on Monday nights, that is accessible from the whiterosesociety.org website, whiterosesociety.org. Download the free two-hour Counterpoint program, as it's archived there every Monday. That's it for us. I'm going to leave you with some music from Bruce Cockburn, and we'll see you next Monday evening. Stay tuned. Art Hansen's up next.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Art Hansen with you on WPKN at 10:05 on Monday night. Thanks a lot for tuning in tonight. I'll be with you tonight until 2 a.m.
too.